because we got dope dad.
Stay
fine.
Chairperson, you've asked us to adopt the agenda. I just want to query, to my knowledge, the NHBRC annual report has not been tabled in Parliament. Because I certainly don't have a copy of it. The only one we've got is the presentation. Now, if it hasn't been formally tabled, then I'm not too sure whether we can, in fact, entertain a presentation. However, I want to suggest if NHBRC is here, just so that we don't have fruitless expenditure, that we go ahead and listen to their presentation anyway. But I'd like to some sort of reason of why the report hasn't been tabled in Parliament yet.
Okay. I think there will be some explanation for that, I guess. We'll just let us move on then. The apologies. None. Then let us proceed and then call upon the NHBRC to make a presentation. And say they will make a presentation of 20 minutes.
And then we've got half an hour for questions.
No, you have 10 minutes for questions. Precisely because they're not right at the part. I don't want you to throw the bone. Okay. I don't want to throw the bone.
Okay, can I respond?
No, we wouldn't respond to the chair. You wouldn't succeed.
Let us proceed. Just saying, I think we'll allow them for presentation as we have proposed, and we'll allow them questions and discussions, and then we'll proceed. Can I invite the presenter to take the floor?
But the fact still remains that it hasn't formally been tabled in Parliament. It's not on our ATT papers. And according to the rules, we actually shouldn't entertain the annual report because it hasn't formally been tabled. My suggestion has been earlier that to avoid wasteful expenditure, otherwise you've got to fly back home and come back again, that we actually do entertain it, but I'd like to know when it's going to be tabled in Parliament.
Chairperson, printing, according to the institution, the printing of other copies have been done, and they will, they are being forwarded to for tabling in Parliament.
When will they be tabled?
Chair, it's difficult for me to say when, but printing is being done currently. Few copies were printed. Printing is being done currently. And I don't think by the end of the month these would not have been forwarded to Parliament. Oh, the acting CEO says they will be forwarded this week.
Okay, no, thank you very much for that. And let us proceed with this presentation.
Here is the meeting of the NHBRC with the World Plant Organization that protects home consumers in the built environment and regulates the home construction industry. And the mission is to provide excellent customer care and service to stakeholders and benchmark the NHBRC technical standards against national and international norms, build capacity around home builders in order to protect the home consumers and promote quality and innovative construction methodologies in South Africa. Capacity advising consumers about their rights, duties and obligations, promote and maintain ethical standards in the home building industry, and to provide warranty cover to housing consumers. The values are customer service excellence, good corporate governance, and promoting technical excellence. And the motto is quality is a priority.
It's just hold on my shift. And there's a request that maybe the best thing that we should do is just to introduce your team. It will be easy for us when we pose questions, and if you refer questions to you as an individual.
The team is led by Sipho Mashinini, myself, and the finance executive director, Courtney, here.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming to the table.
The motto is quality is a priority. And I'd rather move directly to the consumer protection process, because that's where the gist of our presentation would be covered. The process really, or the objective of NHBRC is to protect the home consumer, and ensure and regulate the home builder, so that he builds the houses in terms of the standards of NHBRC, as well as the standards of the country as a whole. In that way, the home builder enrolls the house for the protection for the warranty scheme, and then we do inspections so that the home consumer is protected. And we handle all kinds of complaints, and then we conciliate between the homeowner and the builder, and then we do remedial work if the home builder has not been in a position to fulfill the obligation, their obligation, for whatever reason, and then we generate and we collect and we register the home building, the house itself, so that a warranty fund is created, and that warranty fund warrants the construction quality. And that upper limit is 500,000. Okay. So I think that's the gist of NHBRC in terms of what we do. basically. Then I will deal with the object of the council, which is to represent the interests of housing consumers by providing warranty protection against defined defects in the new home building process, to regulate the home building industry, to provide protection to housing consumers in respect of the failure of home builders to comply with their obligation in terms of this act, to establish and promote ethical technical standards in home building industry to improve structural quality in the interest of housing consumers, and to promote housing consumer rights and to provide housing consumer information, and mostly to regulate insurance contemplated in section 23.98, and in particular to achieve the stated object of this section in the subsidy housing sector. So what we will do now, I'll request Courtney to proceed with the valuable VSP's presentation. And then we will then move to the financial issues that are important to this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To you, Mr. Cooper. What it is, we have the final valuable products, which basically is worked on a turnaround basis. In most cases, if we have a negative, it does not necessarily mean that we don't perform. And I will go to each of the major final valuable products. Registration deals with the number of builders that we re-register every year. So there we had a target of 5,600 builders we expected to be registered. We only registered 3788, which is a variance of 183. At this point in time, we must also realize that the housing market in South Africa has been under tremendous pressure, and a lot of with the decline in the construction of new homes, a lot of the builders did not re-register during the year, because there was just no work. Unfortunately for the builders, it doesn't help them, because it means that if they come back in 2 or 3 years' time, they have to pay the back fees. So, you know, it's a bit of a catch-22. So even though it might be negative, if those builders do come back, they have to pay for the years they were not actually registered or whatever. Renewals were virtually on... All right, then I'm going to go through quickly. The enrollments, which we'll see, is the enrollment of new houses was 78,000. We only did 42,000. We see the financial statements. We see a massive decline in the enrollment of new houses and how it affects the financial. Inspections, the inspection of units, we use inspection process to actually mitigate our actual risk. And in that case, we did more inspections. But the inspection ratio is not really... cannot be linked to the enrollment side because there is a delay year on year. Having houses being built this year, they roll into next year. So it's a cumulative figure when the uptake and the construction. Complaints, that is basically complaints that we expected 2,600 complaints, we only got 1,200. It means basically that less people complain, which is actually good. It means the builders are actually doing their job to be getting less complaints. That's a positive. Withdrawals, there were the top of 80 people who withdrew from the industry. We had nobody withdraw. And the training, we said we would train 9,840 people. We trained 5,676. The subsidy housing sector, the enrollment figure was target was 224,000 units, and we only registered 123,000 units. Just the training, those are the training courses that we actually gave during the year. I'm going to go to one or two of them, like bricklaying. We said we would train 1,250 people, we trained 1,088. So this all comes about what the emerging contractor requires, and as they come and they apply, we provide the courses, we turn nobody away. If we look at the provincial operations, I just think to tell you we have about 10 satellite offices within the country, and that just gives you the geographical spread of the offices. The governance of the NHBRC is the council, and those are all the committees of council. You can read this by here. I don't think it's just to show that there is a governance in place. a central office and our provincial offices. We serve the industry with 9 provincial offices, and each one, and below it, the actual subsidy offices. But I'm saying, come on, you can just read that. Corporate governance and the state investment and non-profit financial performance. What they've done now is just basically showing that NHBRC is what should not have happened and what are we actually there to do and what are we there to protect. Just to give you a quick idea, I'm going to go to the slides so you can see what we actually inspect. So basically, they just are, this picture is not so great, but basically you can see at the top there the soap, the washaways, the cracks along the wall, the bad construction at the top, cracks at the bottom. The kind of stuff that we actually put under the warranty fund. Right, let's go to what I'm actually due for. The actual performance compared to the budget for the year, March 2009. The NHBRC's revenue was $392 million. We budgeted $648 million. We were $206 million below budget. That is substantial. That is basically due decline in the housing market in South Africa. Remember, the budget for that time was done 6 months prior to the beginning of the year, so we put that massive lag. Then we have this thing called unexpired risk provision. It actually applies the IFRS 4 insurance, and that means we create technical reserves every year, and we create provisions for future claims and for future unearned premium, because the premium we receive today, because of a 5-year warranty, does not necessarily mean that we have to spread the premium over the 5 years. So our operating cost was $119 million against budget to a saving of 21. The outstanding claims provision, we had to create extending claims provision of 27. A gross margin was $392 million. Fixed costs were $266 million. Operating surplus was $126 million. Interest received was $242 million, and we ended up with a surplus of the interest of $366 million against the budget of $196 million. So what actually happened? Whatever we lost on the revenue side, we made up in the saving in fixed costs. So even though at the bottom line we still did a lot better than budget because we managed our income and expenditure. Let's go through the elements. That just tells you our major source of income on the left hand side is $465 million, which comes from enrollment of homes, and the next biggest element is the $241 million on the right hand side, which is basically investment income. Right, let's look at the income side on the non-subsidy sector. So the registration and renewals, you see they were virtually in line, were only $1.7 million below voter registrations and voters renewing every year. There we've been through again the home enrollment, $390 million against $554 million. That was the biggest fall, and we know the economic climate. The other figures were virtually in line with the actual budget. Subsidy was a bit of a letdown at this point in time. The fresh enrollments, we expected only about 12.1 million, we expected 50 million. And home enrollments, we expected 42 million, we got nothing. But to add on to that, up to the half year this year, those enrollments are now coming through. So in the 6 months to date, in our September account, you find that the home enrollments and subsidies, it was a delay that is now coming through, and we're way ahead of budget in the subsidy market as of September this year. So it was a delay factor. And in other words, it's just other income. If we look at the enrollments received, you see on the first graph that there's like gray of a color over years. The first one is the premium income. That is the actual enrollment fees we got. That's the first gray line each year. You see what happened in the last year? That massive drop on the white. To 2008, it dropped from $597 million to $319 million. And that is the effect of the slowdown in the housing market. Well, then the earned premium, you see, the pink hasn't dropped as much because that is the phasing of the over the year. That is the IFRS 4 income that comes through that you. Smoothing income over 5 years.
Just hold on a little bit. Remember, say you want some
Yes, Chair.
You're getting lost.
I'm getting lost, but it would appear that there's a slide that's probably not in our pack here. I lost track after the non-subsidy. I was looking for the table on the subsidy revenue, and I can't find it there. And then I started losing track of what was going on. If we could just go back to that slide. You had the non-subsidy, then you had enrollments earned compared to received, etc. Where did the subsidy slide come in?
Enrollment earned.
Right.
And that basically shows the effect of the IFRS 4 adjustment to show that what you actually write and what you actually show in your financial are two different, they're just because of a 5-year spread.
Right.
And then we go to the negative technical liability.
Okay.
So all that is that the differential you have there between the pink and the white and the pink is represented by these technical liabilities, these provisions that we create. And those are the liabilities that we must keep in our books and realize over the next 5 years, over the warranty period. Maybe they didn't get through other things. It's just, they are in this one of 40.
That one is, yeah, obviously we don't have the advantage of having the color thing, so you miss out on that, but carry on.
Okay. Well, if you look at the actually...
Sorry, just whilst you're on this, I didn't want to stop you, but this slide that you've got for enrollment earned compared to received, I'm not terribly sure what's happened to our slide here, but we don't have the figures in here, it's just blank. We've got your little, your little cylinders here, but we haven't got, it's blank.
The premium income to say that is basically what we actually wrote. That's the actual income we received during the year. And after we apply the smoothing of the 5 years, then we get the brown. Now you will see, because we had such good prior years in years 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, those years when the credit was growing, we're now releasing more of those premiums over the 5 years. And those are not coming but towards the end of the 5 year term. And therefore, you get the effect of the good years before now coming through and raising the income above what we actually wrote. So I just put this graph in to show the committee that the actual market has fallen dramatically. So the financial figures don't really reflect, because of the smoothing, what actually happened in the home building industry. Are we happy, madam?
Yes, thank you.
But the next graph is maybe what to add is that what you would pick up from next year onwards, the reduction of the end income, and then you start pulling out from the reserve to cover the future. Because if you look at the budget, we are about 50% of our budget, and at the end of this year, we would be possibly at about 40%. We'll only be in a position to generate 40% of our budget because of the industry growth. So therefore, your reserve would then be useful in the next 3 years because that industry is not going to grow. And the 18-month lag between the economic growth and the people starting to have confidence and start building, that's when you apply that end income to cover the future.
Okay.
I will keep the book in front of us, but it's easier then. If you go to page 13, you'll see the next graph. All that is showing you that the effect of the income is that the expense to income ratio is now becoming a problem, and we have put action in place in order to reduce that expense to income ratio. And when we say student non-cash bonus items, we take things like depreciation, those kind of items that make the ratios look a lot better. That is the actual position. Now, the NHBRC, in order to match its profitability, make sure we're making a profit, we are addressing the expenditure ratio each month to make sure that we still make the profit, even though the income has fallen. We'll then go on to the next page, page 14. It's the same slide here, but Ted, you've got the nice colour ones in front of you. On 14, all the money that we earn, we then put into investment. And you can see then, over the period of time, we put them into cash, bonds in terms of 12 years, bonds in terms of 12 years, and equity. And that creates the return on investment of 260 million. Now, this investment maturity profile we do, and we look at the liabilities of the NHBRC, what they have to pay, what they expect to pay. We then invest the money in order to ensure that we get a positive return, but we don't, but we use a very conservative risk profile. And then we keep the near cash, and you'll find that if you look at the cash element, it's been high because we're expecting more claims. You can see this is just the way we have invested our cash in the market. We go to the next page, on page 15. I'll put it up here, find it. You'll see that those are the returns, the actual reserves of the NHBRC. You see that the blue, if I'm sitting with the financial, the blue is the unearned premium. The unexpired risk provision means there is a shortfall between what the charging of the premium enormity and what the costs are. That's mostly in the subsidy market is a shortfall. And then the same provision is based on actual assessment. Those are the provisions we have to hold in order to meet future claims. So the total reserves are 840 million, I think it is. I'll pick up on the slides now. Going back to the overhead, what I want to show you here is that our major expenses, broken down from the beginning, is the operating expenses. We had an actual expenditure of 118 million, but it was 140. We underspent by 22. Now, this expenditure we use to mitigate risk. So, because the enrollments have come down, we obviously would do fewer inspections. So, we did 88 million rand of inspections against 105. But due to the lower number of enrollments, one would expect this. And we inspect the houses to ensure that they are properly constructed, so at the end of the day, there is no recourse on the warranty fund. The typical Eastern Cape is basically rectification work we have been doing in the Eastern Cape with the Eastern Cape provincial government. Fixed expenditure. Depreciation, you'll see that the actual is 19, we budgeted 34. The question is why? There was a delay in the Oracle system, as we've all known, that we've had a few challenges, and the whole amount that's often capped by the stock is fixed first before we carry on with the next phase. So we did not expend the capital into the next phase until we fix phase one. So we expected to really capitalize it in this year. We did not. We still will spend it in the next year. The depreciation is lower. Employment costs were below budget. Obviously, looking at the fall in the market, we did not fill the actual propositions in order to still maintain a profit for the organization. Training, internal, those are the major variances, 4 million against 17. Consulting was half, and the premises expenses were also brought down because we had an expansion program which we did not implement during the year.
I'm just going to explain. If you look at our current revenue of 392, then you look at the our fixed cost, it's 266. Our fixed cost ratio to income is extremely, extremely high.
Yeah.
And that is constituted the major expenses in terms of our fixed is employment, cost of employment. Now, in any industry, when your cost, when your revenue goes down, you try and reduce a series of your costs. And the challenge, and particularly the information that indirectly we may need to deal with, is that fixed cost of 143. Because the depreciation is basically the system, it's a one-off depreciation, because we wrote off the old system. but we the internal cost of training would also come down because it's a factor of your fixed cost in terms of employment, and your consulting will go down as a result of your activity. But your premises is also a factor of your cost of employment. And most of those are three-year obligations that you, even if you reduce your staff, but those obligations you would remain with unless you bring them down, and then you bring in other tenants on your premises to reduce those costs. So we've got a challenge, and that challenge, given the economic situation in South Africa, given the issue of job creation, again, you find yourself being in an extremely inviable position. Do we then reduce staff during this economic situation, or do we then ride on to the assurance? If you do that, the graph on page 15, that graph will increase substantially. And when that brown increases substantially, you erode your end premium. Those that have been end, you erode that. You reduce then your reserve much more seriously. Now it's a fact of projecting when the economy will start picking up, so that you can, one can begin to live with that. Because if I were to explain, one is that currently, we are spending 20% more than what we are earning on a month-to-month basis, and that is serious.
In terms of the fact, the MHPRC must do an actual variation and evaluation of itself every year and ensure that it is solvent. Now, what the people are saying at the moment, the effect of the forecast budget before action plans are implemented in order to reduce its cost, show that if we look at our adequacy of our fees at the moment, the subsidy market, for every subsidy house that we are enrolling, we are incurring a deficit of R1,100. And the reason is that it's a fixed cost to the amount that you're earning. If you look at the non-subsidy, which has always been where we've made the most that money, and it's been stuck, there's been cost subsidization between the non-subsidy and the subsidy. For the first time in HDRC's history, based on the current fixed cost and the lowering of income, we are now losing R686 per enrollment. This is the 20% that people are talking about, and saying that your income generated against a fixed cost is now in a situation that your enrollment fees are showing that they are not sufficient, and they're not sufficient. At this point, it's time to cut the fixed cost. It means either you cut the fixed cost, or two, well, that's what you have to do, you cut the fixed cost. Or two, then you take the reserves that you've got, because you have those reserves, and those reserves are warranty reserves, and they're also working capital reserves. So by putting the working capital element out, you then decide for a period of time to work on the working capital but reserves, and you ride the storm out. But you don't go ahead and, obviously, the third one is to increase the fee. And that's not the intention at this point in time. So overall, looking forward at the actual solvency, we are solvent, but we are losing R835 per enrollment. The reserves are, that's the one element in going forward. But if you look how we're situated right now, if you look at our liabilities, and we look at the amount of money that we have invested compared to our liabilities, the NHPRC, as at the end of March 2009, is 227% overfunded. Now we're saying of that 227% of the 2.7 million, the top of that billion, we'd be saying is 800 million should be for working capital, and the funding then of 2 billion would be for reserve and for the warranty fund. That's what the analysis shows. So even though we've got this gloom story and we have to monitor it, we are solvent by 227%. The reserves, I think, I've been to this earlier on the graph to show you where we invest the money. Now, just to go, we're going to spend a little bit of time on the insurance provisions, just to clear that in your mind. So what we say for the subsidy market is 582 million rand for non-subsidy, and for the subsidy, 49 million of premiums that we have received that we are deferring to the next 4 years. Well, those are what we're going to live out in the next 4 years. The outstanding claims, they say, based on our claims history, we should have a provision of 67 million for future claims in the next 5 years, and we provide us back for that. And the last one is the unexpired risk. We're saying that we have unexpired risk of 148 million, and that is due to your costs, as I showed earlier, your reserve, your income, being lower than your expenditure. So you have to provide for that future loss. And those are reserves that NHBRC has 848 million, against which we've got the 2.8 million investment. I think that is just the tutorial of the reserve, and that's it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for the presentation. May I take a question from another member? Is there any question?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just going to put a number of questions very quickly. First of all, and perhaps it's got nothing to do with the actual report before us, but I'd like to know since when is NHBRC, or since when have they become a developer? I don't believe it's part of their mandate, so I'd like some information on that, because our information that we gained on an oversight visit to the Eastern Cape, we discovered to my amazement that NHBRC actually acted as a developer. Then I'd also like to know I can't specifically refer to tables and graphs because this presentation was at Schumacher's speed. But somewhere along the line, there was reference to the number of inspections that have increased tremendously. Now, again, my question is, and this refers primarily to the subsidized housing. From the houses that we've seen, and it's not just over the last couple of weeks, but certainly over the last few years, that the subsidy houses generally, first of all, appear to be the floor levels are generally below ground floor level, natural ground floor level. Now, and this continues to happen. Now, NHBRC doesn't seem to be doing anything about that, because almost every development we go to, whether it's 10 years ago or whether it's a year ago, we find the same problem, and I'm not even touching on the quality of the houses. I think some of my colleagues will touch on that. The other question, in terms of warranties, when I look at one of the last slides where you indicated reserves, I think, for future claims or something, your non-subsidy was relatively high compared to the subsidy portion of it. And so my question is related to where we have seen, again, a large number of subsidized houses that need to be either rectified or, in fact, demolished and rebuilt. Is the warranty applicable to those? Does that mean that various municipalities and provincial housing departments can claim from NHBRC for that rectification? And I'm talking where houses were completed. I'm not talking about block projects, where they were completed and they have to be demolished. And in terms of your complaints, if you could give me an idea of the percentage of complaints finalized. One question I do have, your cash in hand is relatively high compared to your other investments. And I think you made the statement that you were expecting more claims. And that's why you're keeping the cash in hand. But is that a wise thing to do? And why would you be expecting more claims? Is it because in hindsight that you believe that perhaps NHBRC hasn't fulfilled their mandate in terms of inspections? Because quite honestly, if the inspections are done regularly and if it's done properly, then we're cutting down on that risk. But your presentation tells me otherwise. It tells me either that you are neglecting the inspection and therefore expecting a higher risk in terms of claims. Then I'd like to know more about the rectification in the Eastern Cape. You've got an expenditure against it, but aren't you doing the work for a department? Isn't there supposed to be an income from that? Chair, I've got two or three more, but I'll give the other members an opportunity. Thank you.
Poma.
Thank you. I also just want to refer, you know, with this visit that we just had to the Eastern Cape, quality has really hit us hard of the buildings, and so we are particularly a bit obsessed with that at the moment. I want to just, on your inspection, now I know that you're not involved, you weren't involved in a lot of these things, but can I, and now you are being increasingly more involved in them, but can I ask you, on your inspection, do you just come in at the end and do an inspection if somebody is registered with you? Or is there an ongoing inspection to make sure that the data is properly mixed? And because this is where, you know, all the problems and the foundations are all correct and that kind of thing. So I'd just like to have some indication of that. The other thing I want to ask you, which I have not been able to get an answer to, and that is, in the developments, and I'm talking now not about RDP housing, but some of the Ramsa housing that we've looked at, the bonded housing, we seem to have done away with airbricks. Can you, as experts, tell me why we don't have airbricks? Because it seems to me that would be a cause for all this condensation inside a building and building up all this humongous stuff inside, you know, with the mildew. So if you could just help me on that. And then what is the, I was trying to understand it, and really we are disadvantaged not having had your reports beforehand because it does enable us to get a perspective on things here. We've got that. But I want to know, what is the proportion of your sort of your RDP housing work, your lower income work to subsidized work, as you refer to it, as opposed to, you know, your home builders. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let us invite you to answer.
There are questions that were raised by Honourable Stein. Since when is the NHBRC a developer? NHBRC is not a developer and will never be a developer. NHBRC gets requested to project manage, particularly rectification projects, simply because we also have an interest in the rectification project because of the warranty that we have. We want to manage that, and because that's one way of reducing our future liability from a project management in terms of controlling, training, and inspecting. We're able to do that, but we outsource the construction because development, as you know, as an engineer, it's a variety of things. It's a very global term, development, but there is a construction. So we project manage this because those projects have come back to us for rectification purpose because they were poorly built. So we're not a developer. We do the risk mitigation, and that we're entitled to do as an entity. And that also helps to do a deliver from A to Z, to ensure that the foundations are done correctly, to ensure that we train the people on the spot immediately. We'll find out that they don't have the necessary skills, and as well as to do the constant inspection, as well as to ensure that the municipality project managers, as well as their inspectors, are also trained to inspect properly in terms of the NHBRC processes. So that is a very helpful mechanism to ensure quality is developed. Okay. Inspection of houses. The current ratio that we deal with, and it has its own problems, is for, I'm going to talk about the subsidy unit, is 1 to 400, one inspector to 400 units. We're increasing that to, because what, per annum, we're talking about one inspector per annum, so not per day, per month, per annum. So that's very important to understand per annum, okay. And what does that mean then? Therefore, is that a person can inspect the number of units that are allocated to that person per annum. But we're reducing that ratio, particularly in rural areas because of distances. So we're increasing the number, and that number is now increased per area. Now, simply because if you are moving from East London to Sobimbaba to other areas, those distances are a major problem. And if you move to the Northern Cape, the distances are huge. So therefore, we now allocate per project an inspector. And then sometimes you find that one inspector has about two projects. Projects vary in size, the 100 units to about 200 units. And most of the Eastern Cape average around 150 per unit in the rural areas. So therefore, we're able to manage that. But what we're also doing now, that's the future, because the agreement between ourselves and the National Department of Housing is that every house, particularly the subsidized unit, must be inspected and certified by NHBRC. We're doing two things. We're increasing inspectorate, but we're also worried about increasing your fixed cost. Because now, when you increase your inspectorate inside, you increase your fixed cost. And that is what was a challenge in terms of the fixed cost. So what we're doing, we're outsourcing that. But then it deals with the volumes. When the volumes are high, you increase. When the volumes come down, you don't have a fixed cost. So that we're doing, particularly in the Eastern Cape. And then we're also increasing our technical ability in the Eastern Cape. The model was that we have centralized technical ability, our engineers and all our professionals at head office. We are now providing, in the future strategy, our engineers will be based in East London. We're providing a set of engineers based on the challenges that have been experienced in the East. We are also centralizing another set of engineers in Tshwane. Because the move from Tshwane to Limpopo is 300 kilometers, to Mpumalanga is to northwest is the same. So we are doubling our inspectors or engineers in the Tshwane area. That would enable our engineers to learn much more seriously, but also to have serious work that would enable them to grow in the industry. Because engineers don't want to be known as engineers for giveaway houses, because you'll get no job in future. Okay. So therefore, we're providing the learning curve for all of those as well. So the another set of engineers will be at the head office. So from that perspective, we are able to fly everybody, the coverage has been increased. So inspection will also be increased in that way. Gauteng is still the major deliverer in terms of the number of units for ourselves. So therefore, in Gauteng, it becomes much more easier because the model is very easy. We place our inspectors closer to the Department of Housing in Gauteng and Metsweding so that they can move. And those about 2 hour distances, the most in Gauteng. Gauteng is a small province, 2 hour distances in terms of driving any part of out of Gauteng. So that's what we're dealing with there. So increasing that capacity at a central level, and then it can move from Bryanston or Woodmead to any distance of Gauteng for about 2 hours. That area is being covered. The question is, why is the 150 millimeter height natural foundation to your footings is not being maintained, and the 1 meter from the hub, because that's what it is. It is a height of 150 and a 1 meter distance. Remember when the foundation, the rough foundations have been done, the inspection takes place then, before you build the house in terms of the processes that we've put in place now. A builder cannot build unless the inspection and the rough foundation has been certified. So it gets approved. But what the homeowner does, particularly in the upgrading area, immediately they build a house, they bring in the soil and they compact it around the house. It's part of the decoration, it's part of whatever they deal with. They are not technically sound. So therefore, let's say about maybe 5%, 7%, at the final inspection, we clean that up again quite often. So it is not the builder, the inspector, or the department. It is the homeowner who ensures that he wants to decorate his house, he wants to plant the lawn, it must be leveled, or it must smooth out without the technical abilities that the evaporation and the moisture, the rising moisture, would move up. And that 150 millimeter is not maintained. That would irrespective of the damp-proof cost you have, because the level of moisture rising is of a significant nature. So therefore, the dampness would take place at various levels to the height of about 300 to about 30 centimeters continuously, particularly at about 5-10 centimeters. That place will always be damp because it cannot contain the moisture rising. Warranties for subsidy, non-subsidy is high. And no, warranties for non-subsidy, yes, it is high, simply because of the value of the houses. Okay, so the warranty for the subsidy is low, again because of the value of those two units. So you look at it, but also the accumulation of the warranty over the years has been on the increase in the non-subsidy, in the subsidy. Remember, the subsidy came in late into the pot, so therefore it is more. From that basis, there will always be that differentiation. Any house that has been enrolled and registered has the maximum, has the warranty to the maximum of 500,000. All right. Not every subsidy house. Because the subsidy house has a construction value of 50, let's say 60,000, 70,000. So your maximum liability is limited to, let's say, 100,000. by cleaning, clearing, foundation and digging, is limited to that level. So therefore, there's that differentiator in terms of the issue. All the houses that were enrolled, non-subsidy, qualify. And I don't want to get into the debate in terms of when and what happened. But there are all kinds of issues that one needs to deal with, because remember that the enrollment of the subsidy units came late. So therefore, and their enrollment, there's been a variety of challenges that this committee is fully briefed on a regular basis about some of those challenges. And I don't think I would move into that area at this stage. We have a turnaround of finalizing our complaints in less than a year, depending on we know our complaints and we respond to them in terms of our current strategy in 36 hours received. This is what will happen, by who, and when you will respond first. But that is when we just inform the home builder. But the issue of complaints is about the home builder, which we have to trace to come and rectify. Some of them have deregistered, some of them have been liquidated. That tracing sometimes takes some time. We are not necessarily up to our game in terms of responding on a regular basis to the homeowner, where are we in the process, but we're upping that game too in terms of what we need to begin to deal with. Courtney, can you take that through to the cash in hand? But I will come back to deal with the S&K rectification, as we've had a three-hour discussion yesterday in that process. But we can start, Courtney, because we were together in that discussion.
Sorry, Mr. Stein, I don't know if a lazy day for the charge for that. If you look at the medicine investment profile, what the NHBRC does, I guess, but you could see, is that we have an investment policy, we look at our liabilities, and we know the last year, interest rates have been very, very high. So it has been best to get the best return with the lowest risk, staying, keeping your money in cash, and investing in that proportion. So come the end of the year, with the whole market collapse, the equity market collapsed, and that's why I chose equity so small. So it was beneficial for us to get the best return at the lowest risk in cash. So at that profile, that time, at the end of the last financial year, before the repo rate started to come down, and the equity market and the bond market are only now starting to pick up, that was the trend over the last year. So it was beneficial for us to put the best return at the lowest risk in cash. What about holding the keeping it to be planned. I'm a vegetarian, and I apologize about that. The other issue is that now, as we do the new business policy every single year, we look at the risk, as we said, the shortfalls, the possible shortfalls, the liabilities we have to pay, and then we say, what element of this should we keep in more liquid cash under a year? And that we keep in cash, but not necessarily the same investment but strategy. So this worked out this year. The idea was that is 100 million sitting in cash, or a billion, which working capital reserves is about 800 million. And that should be cash or net cash. It's just because of the investment trend of the last year that you just synchronize. Next year we might come back and you'll find that cash is sitting at 20 million and the rest is sitting in bonds, because that is the optimally getting the best return on where you put the investment in. Have I answered that?
No. Well, honourable member, just don't forget that time is flying. At 12:30, we have to do the oversight report, a lot of work that we have to do. But also, we are going to meet with the team from time to time. We are going to meet with them from time to time. I think they'll be available and they're invited to come and brief us and take us through. But also, it's important for you to read the report and be able to engage with them whenever we call them, when we request them to come and appear before the committee. Not just once in annual report. I think we have to engage with them consistently. myself to address some of the issues that you observed in the internet. That's an issue that I want the machining to touch on, but very brief. The Eastern Cape, because we'll be finalizing our own oversight report in the Eastern Cape. The matter that we can raise there can be very useful for us. I would then request the leaders that we should then move and deal with other items, and then we'll invite them from time to time, and Paul to come and brief us and take us through some of the issues. Comment.
Chairperson, thank you. I do hear you, and I respect that. If I could, is there no answer on the air bricks? It's really of concern to me, the scunge inside these houses.
I never knew that we had built that one. Okay.
Yes, Chair.
Okay.
Well, Chair, there was the outstanding question about the rectification, the involvement in the Eastern Cape. I don't know if you want to defer that, but I have just one more question which also relates to our visit, and that was that I want to know what sort of does NHBRC teach? And by that I mean we experienced in our last, second last visit, I think it was Mount Freer, where I actually questioned the existence of expansion joints in about a 6-meter wall. We certainly didn't need it. And when I spoke to the NHBRC inspector, the other thing is, even though the engineer instructed them afterwards to put it in, the expansion joint didn't go right to the top. So it actually served no purpose. It stopped about 0.5 meter from the top. When I questioned that, the NHBRC inspector fetched a book where he wrote something, because the joint was filled with grout as well. So in fact, it didn't act as an expansion joint. But he picked it up and he made a note to the contractor, which was probably dated 6 weeks prior to that. They went ahead anyway. Nothing is being done in terms of the NHBRC inspector's instruction. So what sort of authority, what is your the teeth that an NHBRC inspector has? Because they seem to write out notes, the contractors ignore it, and they simply just carry on.
Hold on, let me give it for a second. Just bear in mind, there are still some presentations. But also, by 12:45, we must be in the caucus room. Therefore, we may not have enough time to deal with everything under the sun. Then you will have other opportunities to call the team to come and brief us and take us through. And then I guess that's what we should do. Therefore, if there are questions really that you want to pose, should also be assisting us as we move on to digest our oversight report.
Yes, Chairperson, thank you. I wanted to know if NHBRC was involved during the ratification process in Elliot, and to also further ask as to then how come the re-ratification is needed. If it was there, what was their role then, and what is their role going to be now to ensure that those houses are, the units are re-rectified?
Okay. Mr. Machine, you can take that floor.
Chair, may I request then that we be called back to deal with the rectification process, how it happened. And then we will then emphasize on the Eastern Cape, and we will have a thorough report, and then we will circulate that beforehand to the members. Because given the time, we would be then shortchanging this committee if we are to engage in this. So I would really plead that we be called back to deal with that. That would be extremely helpful. The issue of air brakes is a very simple one. It, the technology is changing, and air brake was more in terms of the hot air goes up. And then possibly go up through the air brake. And because of the size of windows and many other issues dealing with at this stage, but you still do need a series of air brakes, particularly in the showers and the bathrooms and others, because the rising moisture need to go out or air needs to come in to cool the hot air. But the key issue there is that most of the bathrooms, you find them darkened in the ceiling. It's the moisture content. People usually shower and they keep the windows closed. And it's simply an education of the consumer. Open the windows in the bathroom all the time. Simply because of the moisture level is high.
Well, I guess that Mr. Machinin, in the point that you're also confirming that we must have enough time for us to have a discussion around the rectification program. May not necessarily be Eastern Cape. Don't bear in mind that we only visited Eastern Cape. Doesn't mean that it doesn't happen in other provinces. Therefore, the briefing would be broader. Just to give us all the information, what they have been doing, what they should do, whether they have teeth, whether they can take contractors head on a stay, whether they can even arrest them. I'm not sure what they can do, but I think they're going to brief us for this matter. Once they brief us, then we'll be able then to understand the Delta issue. And then I think the brief one, Boma, the most interesting one, I guess we'll have enough time then that day to argue that technical expertise about the building of houses. I think we should do that, colleagues, and then. We should thank them for the presentation, and the secretary is here. Should ensure that we link up once we have time. Just have enough time there to discuss those. I think the Eastern Cape issue was one element that we want to discuss in detail. And because there are really other matters that they think is very problematic. One issue was what Member Stein was raising, that we are also part of development, but I think we have clarified it for. And therefore, we can be able then to have a thorough discussion on these matters and then conclude it. But in terms of the report, the annual report, I think we have presented it in a committee. And then we'll look at it ourselves because we received it this morning. And therefore, if there are other matters also that we think are very problematic on the annual report, surely when we meet again, we'll raise some of those issues. Hopefully, members also raise some proposals if they do have proposals. And then we'll conclude and see what we want to do. It really shouldn't be a one-fourth interaction with you. I think we are very important. But I don't think we did only subsidy, there's a non-subsidy, the overall development in our country. Because the effects and everything are more common now. And I don't want colleagues to become geologists to themselves discussing this matter. I think that people are qualified to assist us to discuss that. And therefore, they're able then to do that. That's what then I think we should do. And then hopefully we will have enough time. I know that the year is over almost, and I'm not sure how long the parliament is going to be sitting. And therefore, we don't have enough time. We may even be forced to Member Bowman to call them even earlier next year if we have time. But we need enough time just to discuss with the I think it's a very important body. I think it's doing a good job, but there are a lot of challenges in terms of how we saw things in that particular area. The point that we raised with the human sector would follow the department just to say these are issues that we observe. It will be important that we engage in conversation on that issue for us to finalize some of the outstanding matters. Can we agree, therefore, that thank you very much, people, and during your team, and we'll come back to you also, invite you to come and be briefing us. And I hope that we'll be able to brief us the state. Even if it's Saturday. I know there are no overtime payment for you, but you must make yourself available because we have enough time then to work and to then entertain all the technicalities. You are an engineer yourself. Sometimes you're always tempted to raise the thickness of the foundation, all these matters. And I think they're very exciting issues. I can also be a builder and future if I listen attentively. Thank you very much for you. Let us proceed and deal with the Rural Housing Loan Fund. Rural Housing also is here. I think I want to start with that one. Rural Housing, and then we come to Social Housing.
Okay.
social housing on the screen already.
It's down the screen already. Social housing on the screen.
Chair, we're having a challenge. The copies which you have are not correct. They are still being printed.
For the social housing. Rural housing one?
They are correct.
They are five. Can you start with the rural housing? Is it possible? When the rural housing is ready, please lead us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. And good morning to the honorable members of the committee. My name is Jaban Farag. I'm the acting chief executive officer of Rural Housing and Fund. I'll be presenting with my colleague, Ms. Jane Potter, who's our CFO. So this is just the outline of our presentation. We'll start with Monday and go on to talk about impact as well as our financial performance. On the mandate, when RALF was established in 1996, we established the mandate of facilitating finance, loan finance for low-income earners so that they can improve their housing conditions in rural areas of South Africa. And then in 2001, when the rural development strategy was announced and the notes were announced by the president, and then our mandate was that we needed to focus more in assisting people in the rural nodes to improve their housing conditions. So starting with the corporate governance, RALF has a board that is appointed by the Minister of Human Settlements, and the majority of the board are non-executive directors, with only the executive director being the MD of RALF. That's currently the position I hold at the moment. So the board of directors basically retain full and effective control over the company. So we report to them. And the board has a number of subcommittees, the HR Ethics and Remuneration Committee, the Credit Committee, which basically, approves all the credit proposals from our intermediaries, the Audit Committee, with the internal audit function being outsourced, and the internal auditors reporting directly to the Audit Committee. And then we also have a development committee. And then internally, we have management committee, as well as portfolio committee, which looks at the portfolio of our clients. And then the sales committee, and then team meetings, which happen every week. So that slide basically indicates the number of board of directors. You can see that the board of directors of RALF is balanced in terms of race and gender. And also what we can also add there is that in terms of experience and skills that the directors bring to us,
It's a very balanced board. Just on the annual report, the key highlight is that we, since inception, we have never received a qualified audit. And the internal audit has also found the controlled environment was acceptable and applicable in the last financial year. We comply with all legislative as well as regulatory provisions. And then we reported a surplus of 9 million in the last financial year. And then basically we also achieved most of our targets. So this slide is a summary of impact. So I will not dwell on it because in the following slides we look at each variable in detail. In the next slide, basically in the last financial year, we set a target of disbursing 35,000 loans, but in effect, we exceeded that target and achieved 40,000 number of loans that were disbursed in South Africa. And then cumulatively, we were able to achieve 681 million rand in terms of value of those loans that were disbursed since 1996. In terms of loan usage, as a housing finance institution, we expect that the significant amount of loans that are granted by RAS and its intermediaries will go for housing purposes. But we do acknowledge that in some instances there is leakage. We have set a target of 70% of loans going for housing, but what we achieved in fact was 28%. So we still had a leakage of 22%, which in most instances is the money taken by borrowers and using it for things like education and other emergencies to basically cover other emergencies that they face. In terms of borrower income, in terms of our mandate, we have to focus more on assisting people earning 7,500 per month. So we have consistently been able, you know, to reach the target market, especially people who are earning 3,500 and less. So if you look at the last financial year, we were able to disperse loans to people earning 3,500 and less, and they amounted to about 59%, you know, of the loans.
Okay, apologies, but may I ask that we, like we did previously, perhaps be given an indication where in the report it is, because I don't know why you guys have gone for this bright pink. It's probably the color that's in nowadays. But on the black and print, it's very difficult to follow the figures. So if it's possible, like we did previously, to give us the page where that slide may appear in the report, I'd appreciate that. So Parliament has gone pink and not the agency.
Okay, I apologize for that. So I was saying that basically consistently close to 50% of the loans have gone to people earning 3,500 less. And that is important to note because those people qualify for the full subsidy. And if you look at borrowing employment, I would say consistently, we higher than 50% of people taking loans from our intermediaries work for the public sector, but still significantly a number of people in the private sector basically benefit from RAS intermediaries. I think to note as well is that people who are informally employed basically still constitute a very, very little proportion of the borrowers, even though we know that in the last financial year there was, I would say, an increase from 2% in the previous financial year to 4%, but that's still very, very low. But understandably so, because this is loan finance, they have to have proof of income so that they can be able to access loans. And bearing in mind that our intermediaries have to comply with the National Credit Tax Allowance. And then looking at provinces, we set the target for 2009 that 75% of the loans will go to
other provinces other than Gauteng. So in effect, we achieved 81% of the loans going outside of Gauteng. In terms of gender, consistently again in the last three financial years, women, I mean, have constituted a higher proportion of borrowers from the intermediaries. In the last financial year, it was 54%. So women are able to access, you know, finance and improve their housing conditions. I indicated earlier that when the rural notes were announced by the president, there was anticipation that we have to focus more in enabling people in those rural notes to improve their housing conditions. We are delighted to know that consistently we have been able to see exponential growth in terms of the number as well as value of loans going to these areas of need. In the last financial year alone, we were able to disperse a little bit over 16,000 number of loans, valued at about 87 million. We still expect to do more going forward, understanding that there is still emphasis on rural development. Continue to play a different role in that regard. Let me at this point hand over to my colleague to take any questions.
Mr. Chairman, honourable members of the committee, just quickly on the financial results before we go into detail on that. I think everybody is well aware of the challenges that the South African and the world economy faced over the last 18 months. And I think just to sort of highlight the sort of area where we're sort of dealing in. High interest rates only started decreasing in December last year. We entered the first time actually in a recession for the last 17 years. High levels of job losses and especially our target market or the market or the section that gets hit the hardest and the fastest in lenders' destination. Inflation remained stubbornly high over the last couple of months. This all eats away at the disposable income of our client base, and then more sort of on our intermediaries that affects them is limited funding in the capital markets was available over this period. Having said that, if we can look at the more detail, and I think most of these graphs I've got, I'll just tell you which pages I am on. This is sort of just a high level look at the key performance areas that we had set for Ralph. And you can find that on page 13 of our annual report. Active clients, we set a target of 12. We ended up here with 11. We actually had 12, and in the very last month, one of our clients settled their facilities with us, so that's hence the reason for the shortfall. JJ touched on the annual disbursements. We had a strategic objective of 111 million that we wanted to disperse. We were very happy to do almost 140 million. End user loans, again, well exceeded our target there. We ended up with a very handy surplus of 9 million rand, which was the best surplus in existence of RALP. We were also very pleased to sort of say we were able to keep our costs under control. And even with the deteriorating economy at the start of the economic downturn, we were very happy to report that our impairment provisions were sort of still under acceptable levels. This specific graph is also in our financials. If you look on sort of page 19, it basically just depicts the growth in income versus our cost. The sort of yellow section is the cost already in the annual report if you look at that graph. Over the last 5 years, our cost has consistently been around the 9.5 million rand level, where our income has been growing steadily. The growth in income is purely attributed to growth in our loan book over the same period. This graph, again, just basically shows how we've been able to sort of manage our costs down. Our operating cost percentage has consistently been coming down as a percentage of revenue, basically just as a factor of increased revenue and the cost staying consistent. Impairment provisions, you'll find that graph on page 18. Again, as an absolute value, we're very happy. The last 5 years, we've been averaging about 16%, which has been a very good sort of base for us in the market that we're dealing in. That is coming considerably under pressure in the current year with more and more financial problems coming through. Growth over the last 5 years, 2005, we still had a small little deficit and then consistently growing in terms of surpluses over that period. This graph, which you can also find in the financials on page 16, it depicts the sort of disbursements that we've got. The first sort of front side, the green graph, shows cash disbursed for the year, while the red at the back shows cash plus mezzanine funding, what we call mezzanine funding. You would have noticed that in the 2009 year, there was a dip in the cash, and that was purely a factor of us running out of cash. We sort of reached the end of the cash resources that was available for Ralph to use as loans. We overcome that by doing what we call mezzanine funding. That's basically putting funds available to our existing clients and giving them a capital moratorium. So in other words, they're not repaying capital on those loans. It's just rolling it over and just paying interest for it. That gives them the use of the funds without actually giving them new funds, if that makes any sense. I've got the detailed financials here. I think if there's any questions, we'll deal with that. I think if we just highlight quickly on the asset side of the balance sheet, you'd have noticed our cash has gone down considerably from 104 million to 68 million. That, as I said, is a factor of the growth in our book. We dispersed literally all the cash that we were allowed to disperse. And you can see that again on the loans receivable side, which went up from 150 to about 190 million. Just to get back touch on the cash basis, I'm not sure if everybody is aware of it, but Ralph is funded from with a soft loan from the DBSA, which has got a very strict liquidity covenant of 30%. And all that means is basically of all the assets that we invest, we need to retain 50% in liquid assets. And that amounts to basically about 65 million rands of cash that we need. On the liability side, you know, there's not much movement there. We made the profit, and you can see that the accumulated deficits of prior years have just about been wiped out, and still funded by the long-term liability there. On the income statement side, revenue grew nicely from 30 million to almost 41 million. That's again a factor of the growth in our loan book. Impairment advances was down from the previous years, and we were fairly lucky in the beginning of the previous financial year that things were really running stable at our intermediary levels. But as the downturn kicked in from about September last year, we've been forced to raise more and more impairments, and unfortunately I have to report that trend has continued into the first 6 months of the current financial year. We're still expecting to see quite a bit of provisions to be made there with clients struggling in the current economic conditions. The interest rate, interest expense is slightly higher, about 2 million rand higher than the previous year. That's purely a factor of when the DBSA loan was dispersed in the previous year. It's just a timing factor there. The other item there that really stands out is the non-interest income and expenses, which swung from a 3 million rand profit in the prior year to about a 4 million rand loss in the current year. The reason for that is that in the 2008 year, we sold one of our investments and we made about a 2.8 million rand profit, hence the nice 3 million rand profit that you see there. And in the 2009 year, we were actually forced to impair two of our investments, where we actually hold equity investments in some of our clients. That resulted in about 2.5 million rand write-down. And on top of that, we had a foreign exchange loss of about 1.8 million rand, which left us with a 4 million rand loss, as you can see there. If we go down to operating expenses, you know, total level, they're just about on par from the previous years. We made, if you go down further, you would see we made a 1.6 million rand share of earnings from our subsidiaries, which is one of our subsidiaries where we actually made a profit and we shared in that. And hence the 9 million rand surplus for the year. I'm not going to go into too much detail on the cash flow side, it's just really a factor of the rest. And that's it from our side, Stephen. Any questions?
Thank you very much for
Honourable members, any question? Honourable Chair, you're welcome. Any question for men and saying, I want to avoid you? I'm attempting to avoid you. Damien Spiegler. Let us proceed then. Comment, you wanted to raise a question?
Yes.
All right, that we should have one just to raise myself too. Yes. Mr. Vlame, or Mr. Fagas, we are generally rural supporting organizations to give loans to rural people. But I can see in your slide is the rural areas like Limpopo is 3.9. There's another one, Northern Cape is 0.1, is in fact Nikichiwu. And then there are only three areas that I think are benefiting a lot from the loan fund is KZN 29% or almost 30%, Gauteng 19%, Eastern Cape 18%. But the real rural areas, general, it seems it may happen that they don't apply or they don't have the money or they don't have information. I'm not sure what is the main reason. Because it seems the Western Cape also is not so high, but it's 11%, it's fine. The KZN, of course, is rural, and Eastern Cape, partly rural here and there. Eastern Cape is rural. But Gauteng and other areas are almost urban areas. Okay, let us proceed. You'll comment as we move on. Someone?
Chairperson, if you want to take some of the others first, because we've had I'm quite happy with it.
No, I'm giving it to
you. Okay.
As long as I'm not budget free, sir.
No, got enough of it. Thank you very much for your presentation. Nice and clear. And can I just ask you, in connection with this 22% leakage, I'm quite interested in this. How do you pick up that people have not used this for the purpose for which it is intended? What is your monitoring mechanism, to ensure that it does get used for that? The other thing I'd like to just ask you, I hear you talking about the new loans not issued. What do you call that thing? Managing or something?
Mezzanine.
Now you don't grant new, but I just want to know, do you have a bad debt as well, or is that entirely managed through that, whereby they are just paying interest on that loan? The other thing, just a very briefly, my last question. I just want to refer you to your board members' meetings and to your member in Pulak. Seems to have a very poor attendance. And also on the audit committee. He's on your board and on your audit committee, and I would think your audit committee is quite an important one. He hasn't attended anything. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be short as well. One of the questions related to the also to the leakages and just to add on to what Member Bowman has asked is what sort of control is applied once the loan is given to in fact make sure that the loan is spent on what it was requested for. Now, I'm not too concerned if people actually use it for education or something else, and I think linked to that I want to ask that percentage of people that you can identify that actually use the loan for something other than housing, is the repayment level presumably quite good? So I'm not too concerned if there's a small percentage of people that actually make use of a loan, and I'd imagine it's generally small loans for some other, as long as it's not to go buy a motor vehicle or have a party or something or a wedding. then the annual disbursements, in terms of your objective, I think you've actually exceeded the objective. Now, it brings me to the question, when you look at setting that objective, do you in fact link it to your available resources? Because if you then exceed your objective and you know you've got X resources, then you're opening yourself up to a situation where you may in fact get the requests, but you don't have the funds. So just in, and then you've reduced your employment costs. Presumably you haven't laid off a whole lot of people. So if you can just tell us how you've done that, because, and it's a pity that NHBRC has left, because maybe they could have learned something from that. And the very last question, and I think this has come up before, Chairperson, and I'm not sure if it was you or NHFC, but there's always been this question about the high cost to the end user. If you could just touch on that again, what is it compared to what one can get at the commercial bank, for example?
Thank you, Mr. Fala.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll respond to some of the questions, and on others I'll ask my colleague Amy to attend to those. On your first comment, Chairperson, I think the issue is about the provincial distribution of rough loans. We do concede that there are provinces which are really, really rural, like Philip Popper that you mentioned, but in which we have not really made significant, you know, inroads. I think that's a function of a number of things. One of the reasons is that we do not have currently an intermediary based in Limpopo. So what we have in Limpopo, we have our intermediaries who are basically based in other provinces, but having established some distribution channels, you know, in Limpopo. Therefore, we are able to lend there. I think that goes to other provinces like in Northern Cape, for example. In Northern Cape, I mean, previously, we just had nothing at all, you know, but we have some of our intermediaries, mainly one using post office infrastructure, being able to lend in the Northern Cape, and another one actually establishing relationships with the building merchants, and this basically assist us to make inroads in those provinces. But ideally, it would be nice if we were to have an intermediary in each province, but it's very difficult for us to identify some of those. We've tried to actually identify some of them, but some of them don't want to get involved in the housing finance. But we believe that using the corporate infrastructure, using building merchants, you know, who work with some of our intermediaries, will be able to make inroads in those provinces. But it's a point that we concede that we are weak on. And for e-leakage, I think Madam Bowman asked about how do we basically monitor e-leakage. On a monthly basis, each intermediary returns to us what we call housing impact monitoring. That basically is, it's constructed using the application form that each lender fills in, or rather each borrower fills in. So they will identify the usage, let's say housing, or let's say education, or any other thing. And then on a monthly basis, the intermediary has to collate that and then return it to us. Because the idea that people should not be encouraged to lie. So if in the application forms there are different usages, you know, then they can indicate what they take the loan for. So they will take that and return to us, and then on a monthly basis, we put that together and then do a collation and they will try to see, you know, how many loans went for housing. If it's housing, was it for extension, was it for connecting to services, or fencing, or all those usages that are related to housing. If it was leakage, that's non-housing, was it for, you know, working capital, for a spaza shop, or something like that, or education. So that's how we are able to get those results. I think the question also is related to Shane's question in terms of what control measures, you know. In an unsecured, you know, business like this one, it's very difficult to have control measures. Like I said, one way to use is housing impact monitoring, where we say people should not be encouraged to lie. They must take a loan for housing, if it's for education, it's for education. But what we are trying to do, basically, is to look at our intermediaries. I think where we benefit most, intermediaries who are using building material suppliers. So in other words, people who want to build, they go to
they test built or any independent building merchant. At the shop floor, they will be able to actually apply for a loan, say to Lenco or Inzu or any of our intermediaries. I think in that way, so once the materials have been delivered, and then we do, the intermediary will do third party payment. Otherwise, instead of giving money to the borrower, they will pay the building merchant, but then pay the borrower the amount of money that he or she may need, say, to pay for labor or something. So that helps us basically to minimize the gate. And in fact, that's what we would prefer, I mean, as a first price, because it will greatly minimize the gate.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yeah, the question on the mezzanine funding and the bad debts possibly associated with that. We've extended mezzanine funding to only four of our clients, and that's the four strongest and four best rated clients in terms of liquidity risk. So we're actually not in, no need to provide for any possible impairments or bad debts on those specific clients. The process when we do that is exactly the same as if we were to do a cash disbursement. It's a new facility. It gets approved by a credit committee, which is chaired by and basically made up out of non-executive directors. So the full spectrum of controls remains exactly the same as for a normal facility. From that point of view, we're very happy that the risk is mitigated to a very large degree. To answer Mr. Stein's question with regards to resources and the budget that we do. Yes, when we actually work out our budget, we actually have to keep cognizant of the amount of cash that we've got, and we have to work out exactly where we can and what we cannot do. To a large degree, the current financial downturn has been a bit of a blessing in disguise for us in the last year. There's been less of a demand from the good clients, if I can put it that way. So we haven't actually had to be in a situation to give them new loans. Next year will be a different story. We're relying heavily on funding from promised funding from the department. We're expecting to get 50 million rand in the next financial year, and that will definitely have to be managed where we can get the best impact with the resources available. In terms of the end user cost of credit, it remains extremely high, and that is a concern for us. The rate that our intermediaries charge is governed by the NCA, and it typically would work out to between 40% and 45% on a housing loan like this. Now, that sounds extremely high. You should keep in mind that they have to provide probably in the region of 25% of their total interest income for bad debts on these unsecured loans. So for every rand that they make, 25 cents has to go for provisions for that bad debt. Our strategy to address this is basically threefold, and it's going to cover not just the interest rate to the end user, but it's also going to cover our leakage to a large degree. We've decided to target more sort of community organizations to originate loans for us, where we can specifically ring-fence the facility for specific use, and at that stage we can actually then offer them a very competitive rate. And in that regard, we're very happy to report that we've signed up one client already, NEPRO, which is the red meat producers and sort of near emerging red meat producers organization. They've got about 45,000 members across the country, and this is going to be for housing loans for those specific communities. And we actually were able to give them a rate which is a fraction of the 45%. Literally, it's in the low teens. And that's the rate that's going to get passed on to the end user. That gives us two things. It gives us low rates to the end user, and it gives us guaranteed impact in terms of housing. And that's what we're focusing our strategy for the next financial year as well. We did our first draft, the strategic plan for the 2011 year recently, and we put a large focus on that 50 million rand that I referred to previously that we're going to get as funding to disperse that to specifically these sort of type of organizations at very reasonable rates. That's the only way we're going to get it down. Our current intermediary base are business people in it for business, and they manage their risks with their revenue. And that also makes it difficult for them to go into areas like the Northern Cape or some of the other provinces where there's just not enough clients for them. So we have to take a different approach, and that's basically the approach that we which we believe we're going to take. And yeah, hopefully I've answered any questions or all the questions, if there's anything.
Thank you. Roman, you want to make a follow-up with that?
Yes. Just a follow-up. I'm not understanding, because on the one hand, with the mezzanine debt, with the mezzanine loan, you're saying that you don't have a bad debt book. Are you saying then that only the intermediaries, and that's where the are the ones that are at risk to have a bad debt book?
Thank you very much, Peterson. My question is around the housing vouchers that you were given a task to work around the provision of the vouchers to the rural areas. How far are you with that process? Because I think we have long been waiting for the report to come, but nothing is coming forward. And then the second question, this one, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask this question to you, because ever since you came before this committee, you were acting. So I would like to know if in this company you act until when, because this position is very much... No, this is serious, because I think there is a legislational policy on the issue of acting. So we need to know, because this means this company is not serious at all. If they can keep people acting for more than 6 months. Thank you.
Thank you. Mind your other.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. That is a slide, the allocation, the title of the slide says Impact Performance, 31st March 2009, Borrower Employment. In other words, yeah, you're classifying your clients according to the employment. Now, I wanted to find out who are these clients, would it be people with a high income earning level or middle or low income level? Particularly, for instance, when we talk of the public sector in particular. Now, secondly, another slide, financial performance year ending 31st March 2009, the annual surplus for the deficit after tax. It seems to that is surplus we are looking at, isn't it? Yeah. It seems to be rising very fast. Well, what's the explanation for that? I hope it's not about, could it be the increasing numbers of the client, or could it be the increasing cost to the client? In other words, I'm looking for whether there isn't an overcharge of interest on the client or not, but it is rising quite fast, I must say. And then lastly, a general question. Do you only provide a loan for residential housing, or do you also provide loans for other kind of construction? Say, for instance, if someone has a small business. We're talking here now of human settlements, not only housing. And within a human settlement, some people might want to start some business to provide certain facilities for the people who have settled. And would you provide a loan for such?
Thank you, Michael. Well, I think let us welcome our councillors, those that we have from Howie, Ten Wolf, and the team. You are most welcome. And they could look well, and
want to make an intervention in future, we allow you, not today. I know that then you can make intervention every time. Not today, you are observing today. You are most welcome and then enjoy yourself. Mr. Fagas and the team, this is a question that I put what? Oh, Damien wanted also for the question. I didn't see that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think you. You were blind, not to see my hand. Maybe you did it deliberately because you wanted me to eat it well. Chair, mine is only three questions because I saw some of the questions you asked when I was going to ask them. The first one on page 67, why is such a large percentage committed not being drawn? Does it not tie up the funds? That is on page 67. The other issue I want to find out is about, I don't know, in the rural areas, if we do have backyarders, because there is no mention about the backyarders that have been helped by this entity. And then in the financial year 2008-2009, the real housing loan report does not indicate a number of beneficiaries. So actually, I just want to know, generally, how many people did we help in this fund? Thank you. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me first start by responding to human yeah, on the voucher program. I think the question is how far have we gone? I'm happy that I'm here with my colleagues from the department, especially with Nafisa. I think on that one, I think we've done everything on our part that we are supposed to do. I think the ball now is the court of the department, Nafisa. Can you please just help me on that one? During the last year, we have been involved with a role to address the question of voucher scheme. And I think honorable members will remember that this is there is already a decision. There was a decision that this will be fast tracked so that we have a presence. We facilitate the delivery in the rural areas. What has happened is that with the new administration, I would say the ministry in particular, reviewed the work in progress that has been done. And in the process, the department identified certain risks which the MINMEC wanted to be, those risks to be mitigated before the process to go forward. Now, it took us several months, possibly 3 to 4 months, to work on this question. I'll give an example of some of the risks that the department realized that the current capacity of ROS, 9 members, and it was not yet, ROS was not yet to deliver at scale in all 9 provinces in addition to their mandate, in that there are only 9 members at the moment. So that risk has to be mitigated on how will it be restructured or geared up to be able to deliver on this additional mandate. That is one. The risk all in all are 9, but I'll just give examples of. The other risk that was identified was the possibility of roles using non-traditional service providers. That means in an effort to reach out to the most remote areas. And there are no service providers in most of the, there is no infrastructure in most of the rural areas, and there was a need to explore the possibility of using non-traditional service providers. They had to be identified, and there had to be a framework on how we are going to, if we are to deal with a community organization, what controls and how are we going to address that? And there were also questions of transport. How are the materials going to be transported? in that we will be dealing with individual projects, unlike in a PNG project we will have maybe 100, 500 units. How are we going to discuss to account for transport to inaccessible areas of the country? And there were also questions of, some of them came as we were drilling down, the questions of soil conditions and geotech. And there were conditions, how are we going to, the cost of conducting those soil surveys for individual households instead of the community, where, unlike in a bigger project, we have economies of scale, we test for the area. But now, how are we going to test in remote areas per household? So we need to gear ourselves and find a strategy on how we'll address that. And those were just the examples of issues that were being discussed. And as late as yesterday, the report was reviewed. And on the 30th of this month, the MINMEC will be seeking to review the latest report in this regard. And that is the date of the critical moment where the administration will make a final resolution. This is where we are as of today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Matthias. And another issue that was raised by Madam Tambuza is that one of the exchange. The CEO, well, the process of recruiting the CEO has been led by the board of directors of our. And all I know is that they concluded the process from their part and made a submission to the minister. So I think at this point the matter is with the minister. The chairperson is dealing with the deputy minister in that regard and the minister. So I wouldn't really be privy to the latest development in that regard. So I'm afraid I'm unable to provide full answer to your question. And then the question of income levels of borrowers. Indeed, the slight majority of borrowers are in the public sector, and the majority of them is in the private sector. But in terms of income levels, we focus on people earning 7,500 and less per month. Basically, a slight preceding, the one on borrower employment, talks about borrower income. You will notice that we said that about 59% are people who are earning 3,500 and less. In fact, if you look at other categories, people who are only earning 6,000 rand a month and or more are only 19%. So basically about 81% are people who are earning 6,000 and less. Those are people who are working in public sector. It could be in municipalities, it could be provincial offices. Basically it's low income and in terms of our market in the segment by income.
Yeah, the question on the mezzanine and where there's bad debt, the mezzanine funding is still to our intermediaries, so they still carry the risk of having bad debts in their own books, but because of their sufficient size and the sufficient capital base that they've got in those specific organizations, that risk is not necessarily carried over to us. Ralph as an organization does have a bad debt provision. If you look on our financials on page 52 of our loan book, you'll see there we've got a gross book of 227 million rand, and against that we're carrying a provision of 57 million rand to book bad debt. That is basically what we do is we get annual financial statements and monthly financial reports from each one of our intermediaries. And based on that, we determine, and we also get information on the quality of their various individual debtors books. And based on that, we evaluate their liquidity risk. And that currently, we've got four clients that fall into what we call the watch list, or they're rated on the watch list. And those four clients are experiencing severe financial problems at this stage. In the current financial year, we've had to raise that 47 to already close to 46 million. And we're still probably at risk after that for about another 25 million rand. That's right, about four clients that used to be profitable that are now really finding it hard in the current economic conditions to raise further funding. Their clients are starting to default on them, and as a result, it's got a knock-on effect that they don't have cash to repair, and so therefore we are forced to take a knock on that. That links well with the question on the growth in our surpluses over the last few years. You'd have seen our surpluses did grow the last few years, and that was as a result of the growth in our book. We actually got more funding available from the soft loan, which we then dispersed out, and then therefore our book grew, and therefore our income grew. At the same stage, we were able to keep our cost base consistent, so therefore we had a larger margin. Now, of this 9 million rand surplus that we reported last year, that's effectively been wiped out in the first 6 months of this year with bad debt provisions, which we will have to carry on into the next year. Ralph typically makes its loans to our intermediaries at a market-related rate plus a risk factor. The average interest rate that we earned last year was in the region of about 14.5%. I'm not sure if we had any other questions. I think there was a question about facilities available on page 70 or 50, 67. That note refers to basically facilities that was approved by our credit agency but was not drawn down by our clients. What typically happens is the clients don't draw the first facility. We don't disperse the facility in full on the first tranche. We basically match it with the need that the client has. So they would draw down on a monthly basis, 1 million rand, 2 million rand, depending on the size of the facility. And all of that line basically means is that we had some facilities that wasn't drawn down at year end, but which was sort of a carryover into the next financial year. I hope I answered to everybody.
There was a question on whether RAF only finances house or would you, for example, consider family and contractors. Well, we do recognize that the pattern is listed from housing treatment services, but we still have to be cognizant of our mandate. Because, for example, with contractors, there's a nature which is set up for that purpose. So we still try to operate within basically our mandate. And we understand that our mandate, I mean, basically, is not cast in stone. It can be, you know, extended. I think we have raised the question in the department in terms of what the achievement settlement means to us. You know. So that's the question that we will deal with so that we can see what else can we do without being accused of basically going outside of our mandate. So we take it into account. Then there was a question by you.
Just a follow-up question on that question, if you don't mind. The reaction of the department on what you say they have raised with the department in terms of providing loans not only for the residential housing but also for businesses. In other words, I'm trying to find out if the department is, how the department is reacting to that.
Department ourselves when we have time, just to engage a department on it. And then, because the human settlement concept general is evolving, and then I think we'll find some of the issues. I think they should stick to their mandate at the moment. Once the mandate is brought in, surely I think they will advance them to deal with other issues on that one.
Then there was a question from Mr. Jamin about the number of beneficiaries. I think what we count the number of loans. We said we dispersed 40,537. So those are loans that went to people who benefited, you know, from that. But we take into account that there could be double counting. Because, for example, in the last financial year, 22% of those loans were repeat loans. Others, people who have took a loan before took another. But again, we take note that the beneficiaries from RAF program would be greater than the number of people who actually took loans, because they are dependent on housing conditions so that they can, you know, so that they and their families or dependents can live in comfort. And then the question of the backyards and what areas. We have seen some of our borrowers taking loans basically to add space so that they can basically derive some income. Let me say for productive or income generating activities. We normally call that productive housing. So it does have certain standards that people will take a loan, at the house or a room, and they can rent the room out so that they can derive an income which they can use to repay the loan or basically to augment their living conditions.
Okay, so thank you very much for the presentation, and hopeful that Jablan one day will also assist us to understand the impact that we are making, bearing in mind that we are presenting a report to policymakers. Generally, they are interested about what is the impact that we are making in the rural area of our country. Then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think COBA deals with those matters. Generally, it's about what impact are we making? Are we changing the quality of life of people? Are we making life better and easier for the rural people? I think to us, that is where the interest is generally that we should do. And then runs and said that people who are much more competent in the corporate side to do this. And I think portfolios is about what impact we are making. Are we improving the quality of women? Because in many other areas, many families generally, I'm not sure how many the percentage, but the percentage is increasing. Women-headed families. And then are we making impact, make life easy for them? They're able now to have houses and proof on the head. I think that's the point that we have to raise. I know that you want to print money card for T-shirts. Okay, no, thank you very much, and thank you very much for the presentation. And we'll just submit. I think we'll also have available whenever you are called upon to come and brief the committee. I think we'll be available for that. Okay, thank you very much. Can we proceed to social housing?
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Brian Moholo. I'm the managing director at the Social Housing Foundation. And I'm accompanied by Andrew Hicks, Chief Financial Officer at the Foundation. If I could just acknowledge the presence of all members, honorable members, and councillors that are here. Our presentation basically it will be two parts. I would give a high level overview of what has been our activities in the past financial year. And Andrew will then start some highlights of financial performance of the institution. That is a way of reminder that we were established in 1997 as a foundation. And that really our mandate is to our mandate is to build capacity for social housing, to promote the concept of social housing, and to work on the development of social housing policy. Our work benefits the subsidized housing market, specifically low to moderate income families. In terms of mandate and values, I think I've alluded to our mandate. That is really to develop a vibrant and sustainable social housing sector in the country, in South Africa. Our values, one is to act professionally and with integrity. Two, to acknowledge and appreciate diversity. And thirdly, to be passionate about service delivery. The key highlight of the year, Chairperson, was the signing of the Social Housing Act sometime in November 2008. And may I just add that the act is now in force since September this year. So, we've also awarded 4 project grants under the Interim Social Housing Program, we have launched a series of new publications, and our website was revamped and it's more interactive, and I'll talk about that later. We have established provincial steering committees, which are committees that are looking at social housing project pipelines, and this is in 7 provinces. And we have successfully completed the turnaround of 3 social housing units. This is our organogram with the board, the office of the MD, the financial and administration department, and operations department. In the presentation, I think you would note our staff profile and people waiting for the foundation. And I think what will stand out is that you actually have equal number of staff and consultants. And this is really because of the transition that we have been going through as the foundation, where we have decided not to commit the institution to employing full-time staff, knowing that there will be a transition and a phase-out of the foundation and an establishment of the regulatory authority. We have about 4 divisions, so just in summary. One is the technical sector support program, and this is where we really deal with capacity issues and building capacity, where we are implementing the rental housing strategy. We conduct good practice or best practice workshops and training, and these are generic training. We provide public support, sector support, and it's all spheres of government, the national department, the provinces, and municipalities. We also support delivery agents. This would be the social housing institutions themselves. We do a number of publications with material related to the subject matter, social housing. We develop a number of tools and products for use by this entity. And we do offer turnaround support. The pictures that we see, Chairperson, this is called Emerald Sky. These are some of the projects that were awarded grants in the previous financial year, and the pictures will be coming through the presentation. What we do with the public support program is really where the relationship between provinces and local government as it relates to social housing are looked at. A new program came out which is called Community Residential Unit. And this is CRU. I think the department has relegated us out of this again. But we work jointly with them on this one. Rental housing policy and rental housing strategy for municipalities and provinces. Because even if you have this policy at national level, the problem becomes when you get to the ground, people do not understand. They don't have their own policy, and therefore they cannot do anything. There's nothing that guides them. So we work with them to really make sure that Western Cape, the city of Cape Town, this is our policy, this is how we'll deal with rental, for instance, the city of Johannesburg. So I think that is what most of the work goes in. And also to look at the issue of backyard rental, that even if we want to forget